I'm trying to figure out how you could work, like, you could take the idea of the Immaculate Conception and apply it to Jesus anally and vaginally fisting at the same time. But I can't.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast.
Yeah, it's time. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. We are a book of the week format podcast that pledges to deliver only the driest, most rigorous literary analysis, and where we pledge never to tell you what beer we're going to pair with the book. That's a catchphrase I came up with back when we revamped a couple years ago now, and I meant to stick with it, but I didn't. This week we are discussing Kaede Kitamura's novel Intimacy, a relatively short novel published in 2021. And I'm sorry, I just misspoke the title there. It's Intimacies, not Intimacy. And I do think that having the plural is quite important, right? And I actually will delve into that a little bit later on, some of the resonances of that title word. Before I do, I'm going to go through the usual brief synopsis for anyone who hasn't read it recently. And spoiler alert, I guess, although this is really not a particular, this isn't really a novel that relies on, you know, sharp, tense plot suspense for enjoyment, so I don't know if spoilers are as much of a concern. But Intimacies is narrated by a nameless female protagonist who's taken a six-month contract position as a French interpreter at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. And there are two main narrative threads to this novel. They occupy roughly equivalent space. The first follows that character's interpreting for the criminal court, briefly during the booking of an Islamic jihadist who led an ISIS-like militia, and at more length during the trial of the former president of an unnamed African country. And I think, you know, in both cases, it's unquestioned, really, that the accused has done basically what they're accused of, but the justness and functioning of the court are much more uncertain, right? Uncertain. And while interpreting for the trial of the former president, you know, the narrator finds that her role as an interpreter brings a sense of disturbing closeness to him, right? And that sense is disrupted by the testimony of a woman whose father and brothers were killed during the ethnic cleansing for which the president is responsible. But then that president is found ultimately not legally culpable. He is acquitted and released at the novel's end, and the narrator opts not to take a permanent job at the court. Now, in parallel, the narrator is meeting and interacting with several residents of The Hague. She's dating a man named Adrian, who several months into their relationship goes to Lisbon to either try to divorce or reconcile with his estranged wife. During that period, the narrator lives in his apartment. Adrian's gone longer than the narrator expects, and he's mostly out of touch during that time. The narrator's also friends with Jana, an art curator, who introduces her to a woman named Aline, whose brother Anton has recently been assaulted under unclear circumstances, which turn out to be connected to an affair, right? He was in a bad part of the city for reasons he could not explain, was assaulted by presumably strangers during that time, and then it turned out he was visiting someone he was sleeping with. And Adrian returns to The Hague, and the narrator chooses not to renew her contract as an interpreter, but leaves open the possibility that she and Adrian might stay together. So I wanted to start talking about this novel by thinking about the title, right? How that title draws our attention to how the idea of intimacy functions in various contexts throughout the novel. And I read a digital copy of this, so I was actually able to do a little search for the word intimate or intimacy, intimacies, variations on that term. I pulled out a few occurrences that I thought were interesting. There's a quote here that has to do with the act of translation where she says, "The depersonalized nature of the task, I was only an instrument, and during the hours that I was there, I was almost never spoken to directly. In fact, the only person who bothered to address me at all was the former president, sat alongside the strange intimacy of the encounter. Depersonalized task, intimate encounter. The entire thing was a paradox impossible to reconcile." So that's one quote. Another quote, there was a great deal of intimate information in the details visible through the drapes, the large kitchen table and the clutter of children's toys, a dog bowl and bed. As it turned out, those items belonged not to Aileen, but to the tenants who occupied the lower apartment. So in that quote, the narrator is drawing a kind of presumed intimacy by looking through the window that she thinks belongs to the person she's visiting, only to discover that that's a totally different person's window. And there's one that is a quote here where the narrator's looking at some paintings where she says, "The artifice of their poses was evident, but that did not distract from the intimacy of the paintings. In fact, it was the very act of posing, the relationship that act implied, that created this sense of uncanny familiarity. In some cases, they were clearly posing for the painter. They gazed into what I thought of as the lens or camera eye, although, of course, the concept was an anachronism. They would have been gazing not into an apparatus, but at the painter himself. The idea was almost impossibly personal, and I realized the notion of such sustained human gaze was outside the realm of experience today." So the key here is that intimacies are often in some way deceptive, right? The title is, if not ironic, then at least a misdirection. And I'm also struck by the fact that the character with whom she's the most intimate, Adrian, doesn't ever tell her what his 2 months in Lisbon were like, right? And she accepts that no matter what their future is together, it will always be, you know, that 2 months, that experience will always be occluded from her knowledge or her understanding. So very long lead up there to the question. But in light of those quotes and just your general impressions of the novel, what does this novel say about the idea of intimacy, or what do these intimacies mean in contrast with each other?
Well, going off of that last scene, that last moment, I think the last of the book, when she is sitting with Adrian and considering basically the 2 months that they've been apart, and he's been with his still wife. They haven't divorced, I believe, and it's evident that there was it's pretty easy to imagine him trying to get her back, his wife. Well,
they probably shared some intimacies.
Yes. And also, having told the narrator to stay and to wait for him in a weird way that made her very, very vulnerable to betrayal, I guess, in a way that she was kind of defenseless. And, I believe that conclusions that she comes to, she thinks of an aged couple that knows each other so well that they don't need to know each other's secrets. It's maybe knows each other so well that they don't need to know each other's secrets is the wrong way of putting it. But there's an appreciation of what intimacy can be at the end that doesn't require her to know what happened to Adrian, at least as I read it. And I think that that's like a complicated form of intimacy where, a complicated sort of understanding of intimacy, because, you know, I think when we think about two people who are life partners and, you know, they don't keep secrets from each other. And there's a kind of a wrinkle in that she's ready to explore at the end. I don't know if that speaks to all of the ways that intimacy the concept of intimacy is complicated in the novel. But that's the one that kind of stuck out to me as really interesting right there at the end. That intimacy does not mean fidelity to the truth or to the past necessarily. There's something else that is going on with intimacy. at least potentially between her and Adrian.
And that intimacy doesn't mean absolute disclosure, right? That intimacy allows
yes.
for the possibility of a space in which secrets can be respected, or some private part of the self can actually be allowed to endure, as opposed to the insistence on kind of... there's a famous Werner Herzog quote that I'm not going to be able to whip out off the top of my head, but he says something like that an apartment would be unlivable if you insisted on seeing every space, right? If you like have a spotlight that lights up the underside of the dining table, the apartment becomes unlivable, and that the human mind is a bit like that, right? You have to allow its hidden corners and its shadowed areas to make the experience of having a human mind livable. I'm severely, paraphrasing there, but... And it's interesting to contrast that, I think, with the criminal court, right? Where the part of the goal of the criminal court is disclosure, is the comprehensive gathering of information, is the lighting up of every kind of nook and cranny, right? It's, and I don't know if there's any... I mean, that aspect of the court, I think kind of like the fact-finding aspect, is not necessarily gone into in depth, so I may be making a connection that the novel doesn't, but it's like the true intimacy of that relationship allows the possibility of kind of a respectful shadow, right? The respecting of a shadow in a way that something like the criminal court, whose mission is kind of absolute disclosure, doesn't have. When I was reading those quotes, even though I chose those three quotes, I don't know that when I was choosing them, I totally really thought about how connected the two quotes were about the act of translation and the act of painting, right? I don't know that I thought about how similar those activities actually kind of seem as they're depicted in the novel. The act of... on the one hand, kind of meeting somebody's gaze for hours and hours while they paint you. And on the other hand, the act of kind of being the vessel for someone's words in acting as an interpreter in a court, or I suppose anywhere else really. But of course, in a court, there's this extra level of emotional complexity that comes from being the vessel of communication for this person that you recognize as monstrous. But in both cases, you have this kind of professional context which allows a sense of intimacy with a subject that is really only kind of created and experienced in this artificial professional way where you're representing somebody in a medium, whether that medium is speech or painting. And you can imagine, I suppose, a painter... You know, if you're a painter, presumably in that era, right, in the Netherlands in the 1500s or 1600s, you're going to be painting people that you know are monstrous. I haven't brought this in yet, but I thought a bit about Lawrence Wechsler's essay, Vermeer in Bosnia, right, where he talks about the, essentially about kind of the stillness and tranquility of the Dutch masters as being something that had to be created in a world that was actually in astonishing chaos and horror. And the, if you're a painter, presumably, if you're painting in the 1500s, some of your subjects are going to be warlords, war profiteers, people who we would today regard as, you know, enslavers, practitioners of genocide. And, you know, the novel certainly doesn't explicitly make that connection or even implicitly make that connection, but they're actually, to be a painter in that time, you might very well end up having a very similar connection to someone that you knew on some level was evil in the way that this interpreter does. So those two quotes are actually probably much more linked than I realized they were until I reread them just now. And this is all, I'm really kind of rambling at great length here, but I think that it is, you know, this is a novel of, I think, deceptive conceptual sophistication. It not much happens in it, and it doesn't really have a lot of It doesn't necessarily feel on the surface like a novel of ideas, but there are a lot of these kinds of interesting connections hidden in it that I had a great deal of fun teasing and exploring when I was writing up the questions. I don't know how either of you would begin to respond to all the shit I just said, but...
One of the paintings that she studies closest is, I think it's called The Proposal or...
The Proposition.
Like yes, that. Yes. And it's, I'm going to hash the description of it, but basically it shows a man and a woman, and the woman is being propositioned in a way that shows her kind of on her back foot. And the painting was painted by a woman in the 1600s, which is notable. And the narrator sees that a woman can see something in the painting that men wouldn't necessarily like. In this case, she's saying that that the female figure is being pressured in a way that is like distinctly uncomfortable, and yet a male looking at it sees it as potentially romantic. And like there is something about, I don't know if it's one-to-one, but hearing you talk about how the connection between the painting and the translating that she does for the war crimes trials, there's a moment, there's a scene where she's translating she and another, because the witness doesn't speak French, but she's speaking French. And there is another pair of translators who are translating the witness to the war crimes of the president. And the story is really harrowing and it's very beautiful. That was maybe one of the highlights of the novel. And I liked the novel, but I really loved that the texture of that scene, the mechanics of just describing how the words are no longer coming from the witness's mouth, they're coming from the narrator's mouth. And there's this incredible intimacy that she has with this person who has suffered terribly. And yet, and her testimony is profoundly affecting and powerful. And yet the president is not convicted in the end. So despite the intimacy and the skill with which the painting captures this moment that a man is pressuring a woman and making her uncomfortable, it's possible for that to persist, for people, for it to hang on the wall and for people to call it the proposition and for, you know, people to continue to view it as, you know, almost a romantic thing. And despite the intimacy, the really profound connection that forms in this is really strange way between the narrator, this other pair of translators, and the witness at the trial, the trial is, I guess you could call it a failure if you're saying like the function is to punish this person who, I think the book makes it pretty clear, is a monster, right? Like we're not really meant to read it as like he's potentially not culpable. Like he's culpable morally, but not legally.
So thinking then about going back to the way that I framed the question originally, right? What do these intimacies mean? It's partly about, there's this whole idea of kind of intimacy with the complicated subject, right? Or the appearance of some form of intimacy, which is very strong but narrowly defined. Are there other ways in which the novel is partly about how intimacy is illusory, or ways in which the feeling of intimacy is something that tricks us or misleads us?
There's a lot in this novel that feels paranoiac to me, and I want to be careful like saying that, because I don't really want to imply that the narrator is unreliable, but it reminded me of the class that I think all three of us were in it with Eric Heine on paranoid fiction. And there is an element of trying to map the incomplete information she gets about the people around her onto narratives that like explain the gaps. And so to me, I think that the thing that is hard is I don't necessarily think that we actually see her really intimate with anybody, like really, like, and so she does a lot of projecting into the spaces that she really doesn't know or can't know or doesn't want to ask about. And I don't think that she's necessarily confusing in that with intimacy, because I think that like, but I don't know that we actually see an intimacy between her and any other character, even Adrian, that is shown to be misleading in some way, because I don't think she's like, I think Adrian is kind of a mystery to her from the very beginning through, you know, most of their relationship, I don't know, it'd be hard to say that intimacy is shown as like potentially misleading here, because I don't think that she actually like gets a very strong connection to anyone around her,
right,
really ever.
I suppose if anything, the title of the novel is more a reference to the ways in which she experiences or observes a number of intimacies that are not what we would normally think of as intimacy, right? The ways in which she experiences or observes a range of types of possible intimacy that are distinct from the ways that most people would think of or hope to experience that concept. You mentioned the paranoia class, Chris. I don't know if I can connect this to this novel, but I'm reminded of a comment that you made in that class. We read Bodily Harm by Margaret Atwood, and I remember you had a point, and I might be mischaracterizing this. You can correct me if I'm misremembering it, but my memory of your thought about Bodily Harm was that the protagonist of Margaret Atwood's Bodily Harm spent a great deal of time interpreting everything around her through a lens of gender, having a series of experiences that she thought were about her position as a woman, and that actually ended up being about totally different things, right? Ended up being about, you know, this kind of much bigger sociopolitical intrigue that she happened to be in the middle of. And there was something about the way that you said it that made everybody incredibly uncomfortable, because it seemed anti-feminist. Like you tried to just say that you said basically that the novel was about someone interpreting everything around her through a gendered lens and turning out to actually have that be a misunderstanding. And I think because we thought of Margaret Atwood as like a feminist author, everyone was very uncomfortable that you were proposing that it was a novel about somebody reading the world through gender and actually that being reductive and oversimplified. But then at some point, we all figured out that you were kind of right. And I felt kind of bad that we had sort of, you know, we'd been on the verge of kind of trying to find a polite way to slap you on the wrist when you had actually nailed the idea of what was happening in the novel. And I bring that up only because you know, when you say that this narrator is when you say that the narrator of Intimacies is paranoid, paranoia is about, ultimately, paranoia, as we think of it in at least a literary context, leaving aside kind of the, you know, medical framework. But when we think about paranoia in a literary context, we think about everything being connected, right? Characters who perceive connections that are not there. Characters who, particularly perceiving connections that aren't there, that make everything about them in some way, right? Like in Bodily Harm, the narrator had this kind of idea about how people would approach her and relate to her as a woman that actually turned out to kind of end up, was the framework that she used to understand what was happening and actually ended up obscuring her understanding of what was really going on. Is there some way in which, when you say here that the narrator is paranoid, is there some way in which she's seeing connections that don't exist or kind of understanding things as being about her that are actually happening on a bigger scale?
Yeah, again, I don't necessarily want to characterize her as a paranoiac character, like a paranoiac viewpoint character in the literary sense. But there did seem to be paranoid tendencies with Adrian and her friend Yana, right, when she shows up late to dinner. And they have been together for half an hour without her, and she is really kind of drifting quite willingly into this and easily into this idea that they might have had shared some sort of intimacy without her, right? And similarly, when she meets Anton, couple times with Anton and Anton's sister, and there is this similar to Margaret Atwood, Bodily Harm, but Margaret Atwood in general as a writer is really like adept at capturing the prismatic qualities of what it's like to wonder what other people are thinking or wonder about the motivations of the people around the viewpoint character in otherwise mundane circumstances, and really to draw that out and investigate it thoroughly, so that, like, you know, like someone says something offhand, but it's not just offhand. And then we get several paragraphs of digging into what it could mean. There's almost a politics of human connection and dialogue. And there's definitely some of that here. And I think really the only place for a character to go, unless they're really a savant and able to just sort of like understand other people based on the minutiae of their behavior, mostly I have to read that as more illuminating of the viewpoint character's, you know, mindset than actual reality. Like she's wondering if Adrian and Yana, you know, fucked in the half an hour before she arrived, or kissed, or like they realized that they like were hot for each other. And like, she's picking up on all these cues that sort of feed that fantasy, but it's a paranoid fantasy, you know, that's the first one that comes to mind, but there's a couple of others that I'm not going to be able to like jump to. But I think the character, and you have another question in your set of questions that kind of goes into this. The narrator is very introspective, and somehow somehow does a lot of interrogation of like the characters of the people around her with less than perfect information, you know, she like she reaches a kind of a potential idea about Anton that I didn't quite get. You know, it's implied that maybe he wasn't beat up or mugged. You know, I think at some point, and I didn't quite get there. But all that to say, like, it, not necessarily paranoid in the fullest sense, where like she's making it about her, but paranoid in the sense that she's crafting narratives to knit together the disparate bits of information to explain the behavior of the people around her, and that does relate back to her because she cares very deeply about belonging to this place that she has moved to and being accepted and having connections there. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I wouldn't call her like full on paranoid, but there's definitely like, to me, paranoia threaded through the novel, through her kind of relationship to other people and the way that she just wonders constantly, like, what they're doing and why.
Well, and what you're talking about in that particular scene, I suppose, is jealousy, right? And jealousy and paranoia definitely go hand in hand. And the jealousy, I think, is interesting because it connects to something else that I found myself wondering about with this character. And maybe I'm being unfair to her in the way that I think about this or frame the question. I don't know. But, like, even though this character is very introspective and thinks and observes and ponders a lot, we don't really get much of a sense of, to put it frankly, what all these people are seeing in her, right? You know, she keeps attracting the friendly and romantic and sexual attention of all these attractive, wealthy people in these positions of glamour and power and status, but she herself never really says much in dialogue or does much that really feels notable. She describes herself as not being particularly beautiful. It's like she, the interest that all these people have in her, one of a couple things is happening, right? Either she is not describing herself in an accurate way that reflects her kind of real being, which would, in a weird way, make her an unreliable narrator, right? Everyone is interested in her. Everybody wants her around. Everybody, all the wealthy, powerful men want to date her or sleep with her. But she does not show us what it is about her that creates that pull, which is, I can't really think of another time that an unreliable narrator has functioned in quite that way, and maybe it's not even fair to characterize it that way, but there's something that she is leaving out of how she views the world, which is the missing piece behind her kind of entry into this society that she really pretty effortlessly penetrates to a fair amount of, again, intimacy of a sort, right? I don't know, maybe it's unfair of me to say that we don't get a sense of what it is about her that all these people are drawn to, right? Maybe there's something I'm missing or leaving out in an unfair way. But, you know, there is a kind of oddness to that. And I think the insecurity that is suggested, right, by her not telling us what it is about her that all these people are drawn to, that insecurity is, it comes through in a couple ways. It comes through in the intense jealousy that she feels in around the possibility that maybe Yana and Adrian just fell in love in the half hour that she wasn't there to police them. And also in the ways in which we are not kind of privy to what it is that they are drawn to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I wonder if she, I don't know, this may be apologia on behalf of the novel, but I thought about it when her boss is saying that, you know, hey, you're really good at this job. We'd like to give you, like, offer it to you full time. And while you're in the, you know, narrator's head, she's so conscious of, like, all of the little, like, emotional hurdles that she jumps or fails to jump while trying to be a good translator, that it seems a little bit like maybe we don't get the picture of her from the outside, how maybe competent and maybe competent / mysterious a quiet introspective person can come across as when she's not like wearing all of her feelings, you know, on her face. But I really don't know. Like, it does seem like every dude that she runs into wants something from her, or that's at least her perception. I don't know. Like, I don't know how. Like, there's a line about I can't remember Anton's sister's name. What is Anton? Elena? Eileen. The narrator's leaving Anton's sister Eileen's house, apartment, and Anton's also leaving, and with a glance, Eileen communicates concern to the narrator about the narrator being alone with Anton outside for the brief moment that they're going to wait for a car. And there's so much in that that, like, I instinctively don't trust that. I guess there is like an element of unreliability to the narrator to me, because I just don't, at least I don't know what that would be like. To either like be able to communicate that with a glance to someone that I've known for like a few hours total, or like believe that I understood that. Like, does that make sense? Like, I can't tell. I really do want to like this book, but there is a lot that I kind of like when I think about it, it feels like I can't pick it up and examine it as much as I want to. And part of that is like why exactly the narrator is as popular as she is.
I suppose it's actually another form of deceptive intimacy in a way, right? The intimacy between the narrator and the listener, the way in which the deep intimacy of being the person to whom this story is told, and the ways in which that is betrayed by us ultimately somehow not understanding how the people around her see or experience her in spite of being subjects to this very intimate interaction. Patrick, you've been a bit quiet. How did you feel about this novel?
It definitely was a little bit opaque to me. I'm going to be honest. You know, like hearing you guys talk about it, obviously, like I caught on to the fact that, you know, it's about intimacy, and obviously there's an interesting juxtaposition between the fact that the narrator seems to have greater intimacy with the former president than she does with her boyfriend. So there's that, which is intriguing. And, you know, you guys have mentioned some other things that about ways in which intimacy is portrayed that I definitely find interesting. I think one of those quotes you pointed out, Hans, was about like looking through curtains or drapes. And so like there's this intimacy at a distance, or intimacy from voyeurism. So that's pretty neat.
Right.
But I suppose so on that side, I definitely think the novel is very interesting, but I also think that, like, I'm trying to think of a novel as tantalizing as this one is, that also seems to amount to very little.
It's definitely a questions novel, not an answers novel.
Right. Like, I keep, like, during your discussion, I keep thinking about the novels of Jane Austen and how, like, how intimacy, you know, I don't know if Austen typically, like, ever really wanted to, like, deconstruct the concept of intimacy specifically, but certainly, like, all of her famous novels deal with a lack of information that the characters have about each other. So, like, de-intimacy or whatever the opposite of intimacy is. And how that lack of information, that lack of intimacy typically causes trouble. So, like, for Emma, in Emma, her inability to understand, like, what other people in her sphere really need causes problems for these other people and for herself. So, you know, and, you know, in Pride and Prejudice, so Elizabeth's lack of understanding about Darcy, like, not seeing through his kind of cold, dignified exterior to see that, you know, he's quote-unquote decent. You know, like, what decent is up for debate. You know, he's kind of an asshole, so is he really, really decent? But you know what I'm saying, right?
I mean, you're kind of an asshole, but decent.
Sure. No. Oh, that's true. Hey, that, I'll take that as a compliment. Like, you're like a character in an Austen novel, Patrick, and a famous right. one.
You are the Mr. Darcy of the Book Spider
yeah,
podcast.
That's great. This made my day. Like a less handsome, you know, Darcy. That's pretty great.
Those are really interesting examples, I think, though, because those are kind of all, I mean, they're very determined and didactic, right? They're making a very clear point about assumptions versus real understanding and kind of information asymmetry, right? And there are ways in which, well, I don't know if, I mean, maybe to some extent, like, this is actually a novel about assumptions versus understanding and information asymmetry. And maybe it's not so, I mean, you can tease a lot of interesting questions out of it, but it is ultimately a novel about, boy, I started that sentence so confidently as though I could just whip out the answer. But it is about the difference between true intimacy and the perception of intimacy and the assumptions that we make that give us the impression of a type of intimacy without necessarily having the warmth and health and communication of true intimacy. And I guess, I mean, it's basically about a bunch of different ways to feel like you know someone or feel connected to someone without really being so. And then at the end, a moment of true connection, which paradoxically involves the tolerance of something being hidden, right? And that's, I mean, I suppose when you boil it down to that, that's not so complicated, really, and even not so much more enigmatic than, you know, Jane Austen or something like that. I mean, I think it's kind of built in a way where you can reduce it to that, but you can also kind of dig into all the what does this say about this and what does this connect to this kind of stuff about it, right? And I think I like that about it. I think I admire that about it. It's easy, I think, to take it as being plainer and simpler than it really is.
I wish we got more of the president, though. Like I think that, like, for Patrick, you said that the narrator has a more intimate connection with him than she does with Adrian, and I think that you're right, but I wish that that was less conveyed by, like, a couple scenes and mostly, like, the narrator's sort of thinking about it actually like God, there's like a version of this novel that is like where what we've read is like a frame around like very like detailed information about the trial and about like all of the stuff that went on that I love the idea of that. Like, because the thing that, like you said, Hans, is like information and fidelity to the truth is not the same thing as intimacy. And that's kind of, at least the place, the kind of realization that she comes to at the end, that, you know, intimacy could actually sort of like let go of, you know, detailing the past crimes, you know, and just sort of like, but I wish that was juxtaposed against real detail, you know?
You know, I have to admit that, like, as I was reading this novel, I often found myself thinking, I wish that this were just the stuff about the court, right?
Yes.
When it would go back to being about Adrian and his marriage and his apartment, I would think, I would feel a little bit deflated, you know? It would go from being something that, if it were just a novel about Adrian and you describe, and I read the back of it, I would put it back down and go, no, I'm good, right? If it were just a novel about the court and I read the back of it, I would go, okay, yeah, cool, let's do this, you know? And I do think that at the end of it, I appreciated the kind of structural symmetry of it, and I did recognize the ways in which there are interesting questions about the nature of Jesus. I'm so tired of saying the word intimacy, but interesting questions about the nature of connection that are you. There are things that you can do thematically with those paired narratives, and I think that there you can. It has a kind of artistic wholeness to it, the way that it's constructed. But while reading it, I often couldn't help wishing there was no Adrian thread, and it was just about her experiences interpreting in the court.
Man, you guys really deflated me. Oh, man. I have been silent this whole time thinking I'm going to drop a bombshell on these two guys who aren't even thinking on my level, man. And then you go ahead and say what I was going to say, which is that, you know, basically, one of the reasons that I feel a little standoffish about this novel is like, and one of the reasons why I compared it to Jane Austen, like, what's good about Jane Austen novels, you know, maybe. So, I'm gonna say that I think that, there are levels of didacticism that are acceptable in a novel, you know, like depending on what the novel is. Now, I don't tend to think of Jane Austen as extremely didactic, actually. Like,
not insufferably so.
Well, you know, insufferable to you is, you know, you probably have a. You're the bar for you for something to be insufferable is probably like lower for you than me. And
that's just how it is. Yeah. That's nothing against either one of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just how it is. What I get at from this novel, like it's kind of ambiguous. Sure. If you really dig down, it is probably saying something interesting about intimacy, but like it doesn't have it doesn't have stakes that make sense the way a Jane Austen novel makes sense when it's thinking about intimacy or hidden information, you know, like, so in Pride and Prejudice, our stakes are, will the Bennet family be bankrupt? Like, are they going to be able to survive? Right. And that makes sense to me as kind of a backdrop. Whereas in this novel, when you want to talk about intimacy, the backdrop is a former president mass murdering lunatic who should probably be in prison forever. And that's going on in the background, but we're supposed to care about like her, you know, her boyfriend. Is her boyfriend fucking his ex, his wife while he's gone? Like, I'm supposed to care about that? Well, so what I'm saying is I think it's a more, I'm having a more extreme reaction where I really feel, not that I just wanted more of the president and the criminal court, that I feel really let down that I didn't get it. Like a novel set in the ICC about an interpreter trying to like maneuver this case. That's really interesting and could have been the foundation for something larger and but instead we have this novel, which, so I'm a little disappointed, is basically what it amounts to.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I mean, and I think that it might be to some extent maybe partly a byproduct of the kind of opacity of the protagonist, the narrator that we've already talked about, right? I don't think that it's outside the realm of possibility that a kind of romantic will they, won't they could be made so compelling that it would be, that it could stand on equal footing with the ICC. But I don't think that we get any sense of the, we don't really get a sense of why Adrian is a matter of such emotional urgency for the narrator or vice versa, right? We don't get any sense that, you know, if she were to just not get Adrian, I don't have any sense. If the novel were to end with them reconciling and being, you know, on a footing to be in love forever, or if the novel were to end with them saying, nope, I didn't feel beyond the kind of difference in scale between that and the ICC, there's just not that much that's uniquely compelling about how their romantic chemistry is portrayed, or any sense that winning or losing this man will really have that big an impact on the narrator's life or being, you know? And I don't know, maybe other people, maybe it's there and other people are getting it and I'm not, or maybe there is actually something thematic in the narrator's intense attachment to this thing that to us doesn't seem to have much value. You know, maybe that is a point in some way, but it did feel a bit like a missed opportunity. Do you guys have any other thoughts about anything else about the way that the personal aspects and the political aspects kind of bolster each other here, right? Like, is, you know, if you wanted to make kind of an obvious facile reading of this novel, right, you could say that, you know, the president is fundamentally a charismatic man, and his being a charismatic man has allowed him to kind of get away with these big monstrous things, and Anton is a charismatic man, and his being a charismatic man allows him to get away with much, you know, a vastly tiny version of that same thing, which is to say being a philandering scumbag, but that those are actually kind of, those are the same social or personal pathologies writ tiny and writ enormous. Is that a dumb, simple way to think about it? Or is that a fair way to think about it?
It's not dumb. Like, I guess the only difference between Anton and the former president is the scope of their power, right? I don't know if the novel is interested in saying this, but it seems to me a logical consequence that if these like character traits are common to both Anton and the former president, then the difference is in the social situation that has limited their action, because Anton is, you know, a bookstore owner. You know, he can only, his character traits can only do so much for him. Whereas if you're in a greater position of power, your harm can be much greater. So is the novel saying anything about that? Is that like something that the novel's trying to get at, or, you know, again, it's opaque.
I don't know if it's saying anything that's any more nuanced or original than just like these things are equivalent to each other, but with a difference of scale and opportunity.
I did, however, before you do the outro or whatever, Hans, I did want to point out, I really enjoyed the scene where Anton and his side chick,
oh yeah,
get back from the restroom in the restaurant, and the narrator notices, like she understands they've just got done performing some kind of sexual act, probably in the restroom, and she notices that they seem a lot less interested in one another, which I thought was pretty funny, pretty good line. Like, I don't want to talk like I like ultimately like I thought while I was you know listening that I definitely thought there was a lot of strong stuff about this novel. So I don't want to leave just saying that I was let down. I also want to admit that, you know, there was a lot of really good heady stuff in here. But bump.
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think like we've definitely said some critical things, and I think there might be to some extent a question of us like interpreting features as bugs, right? Like the question of whether or not Adrian's relationship with the narrator is actually supposed to be compelling, if it has actually a flatness to it, or if it's kind of hard to give a shit about it, like that might actually be an artistic technique rather than a failure. That might be thematically important. I certainly want to acknowledge that in particular. I mean, I think that I had a great time reading and thinking about this novel, and I probably had a better time writing the questions than I have for maybe any other novel that we've done for the podcast. I mean, I think it is a narratively simple novel in which not much happens, but in which the observational capacities of the narrator lead to an awful lot of really interesting opportunities to tie things together and see connections. And I found it quite interesting in that way. And I think it definitely rewarded, you know, if I had kind of grabbed this from the library and kind of read it here and there in passing, I think it does have, you know, we've talked a little bit about like how the podcast leads you to almost sort of misread certain books where you go into them kind of trying to extract a thesis or tie things together in a way that maybe they don't want, right? That like the informational environment of a podcast, the analytical environment of a podcast cause you to kind of push books to be something they don't want. And this is, I think, the opposite of that, right? This is a book that I might have read in a more fleeting, casual way, but because I was circumstantially required to squeeze and see what juice came out, you know, I got a lot out of it, and I really appreciated it for that.
Proved to be extra, extra juicy.
Right, right. I think you can concede all that or enthusiastically assert all that and still also recognize that ultimately, if it were twice as long but entirely about international criminal court proceedings, that would probably be something I would be more psyched to read.
Right, yeah.
Agreed.
So is it Patrick's turn next?
Yeah, it's my turn. I really wanted to kind of read something topical. It's called Gate of the Sun by Elias Koury, and it is about some Palestinian refugees surviving in a refugee camp in Beirut. And it just from a description of the novel, a doctor tells a story to a man in a coma in an attempt to keep him alive. The patient, Yunis, is from Galilee, where he left Nala, the love of his life. The novel unfolds at his bedside through Dr. Khalil's intimate and haunting flights of memory. So that, you know, that really, that sounds like an interesting novel to me, even though
it's sort of like the English, it's like the English patient.
It does. Like it actually, like reading it now and hearing you guys, like that's totally the English patient. I don't.
The Israeli patient.
This was written in 1998. The English patient was what, like 1994 or 1992, 1996, something right. But yeah,
no, actually, the description that you've read actually sounds really intriguing, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is long. The audiobook is 20 hours. So that could be close to 600 pages. Fuck
me.
So if we need an extra week or something like that, that's fine.
Yeah, it's 550 pages.
Need an extra week. I'll say that now.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, 3 weeks it is then.
Sorry, can you say the title and author one more time for me?
Gate of the Sun by Elias Koury. You know, his last name is Khoury, so it's probably something more like Khoury, something like that.
Okay, I'm sure I can find it with the title.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, you heard it first here, folks, and probably nowhere else. our next pick will be Gate of the Sun by Elias Koury. Thanks much for your listenership. Always appreciated. Feel free to reach out to us at bookspider1001@gmail.com. And we'll talk to everybody in about 3 weeks.